You know, Spencer, I have to ask this anecdotally in a way. I mean, why do we just never hear about voting problems in white upper-class neighborhoods? I mean, we never hear about, 50,000 white upper-class individuals waiting 12 hours in line to vote. Why are these problems really most apparent in communities of color?
Right. Well, one problem is that elections are funded on a local level. Right, so it's not unlike schools or some other services, and it's probably even worse than schools and police services, because often localities feel like they need to invest a certain amount in schools. But if there's a place to cut, it might be elections. So one problem is the fact that elections are funded on a local level based on property tax and local tax, and so that's one big issue. Another significant issue is that often we have poor communities where, if people are working, they have to vote at a particular time. Maybe they don't have as much flexibility in their schedule, and so maybe they all come in right after work, or the lines go up then. And so there are a variety of issues related to just kind of socioeconomic challenges and difficulties. And the objective of democracy, Chris, should be to make voting easy for everyone. We don't want to make voting a test where the question is, can you punch this ballot in a particular way? And if you can't, then we don't care what you think. Or can you read English in this perfect way? And if you can't read this complex ballot initiative with complex legalese language, then we don't care about your vote. We really need accessible voting, and we need to open up access. The objective of government of voting is to ensure that government reflects the will of all citizens, not just some. We really do want government of, by, and for the people.
I was amazed after the 2000 election, the French election minister went on BBC and he showed off the French voting method, which is a very simple yes or no paper ballot. Mm-hmm. When we talk about these methods of voting, you talked about the ballot there in Florida in 2000. Here in New Mexico, we don't have a paper trail for all of our ballots per se. We have a lot of electronic voting machines mm-hmm. that don't produce a receipt.
Right.
What could be the backlash of this? I mean, I know there's always problems in technology,
right.
But there seems to be particular problems with voting technology.
Right, that's true. Now, Chris, I think we do need a paper trail, and that's important, but a paper trail is not enough. There was a study done where a machine intentionally made errors, and only about 1 out of 10 voters caught the error on their paper trail so-called receipt. And so the paper trail is important, but it is not enough. We need important audits here to check these machine makers, the officials who administer these machines. We need audits. We have audits of private corporations in order to protect shareholders. There's no reason we shouldn't have audits of these machine companies and the election officials. So I think we need these procedures in place. Certainly a paper trail is the first step, but we need some other steps as well.
You know, when we talk about also here in New Mexico of the election process, mm-hmm. A lot of communities here in Santa Fe, we're a immigration free zone, which
right.
means that per se, we don't necessarily enforce a lot of immigration laws other than federal stings and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But to the same extent, a lot of communities have adopted a bilingual ballot here, and that's been contentious
right.
even here in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think we should allow bilingual ballots out there? I mean, we ask people to understand English to become citizens, right?
Right. So bilingual ballots is not an immigration issue. People talk about, well, should they learn English before they come here to the United States so they can vote? Well, 70% of the people who use bilingual ballots are American-born citizens. And I think it's pretty difficult for us to tell American Indians whose foreparents have been here for thousands of years that because you respect your tribal traditions and heritage, that you can't vote for president of the United States. Also, people say, well, bilingual ballots divide America. No, they unite America. If you look at Lawrence, Massachusetts, for example, before bilingual ballots, the schools were 70% Latino, and there were no Latinos on the school board. The mayor largely ignored the Latino community and scapegoated it, blamed the problems in the community all on Latinos. There were riots between Latinos and Anglos. But after bilingual ballots, the school board and the city council became integrated. There were coalitions between Anglos and Latinos, and the mayor really started to listen to Latinos, the Anglo mayor, and started to lead the entire community. So translated election materials are needed for the same reason that literacy tests are illegal. We want all citizens to have a say. Literacy and English are certainly good skills, but we shouldn't dehumanize citizens by excluding them from our democracy simply because their language skills are not as strong.
You know, also something that's become somewhat of an exclusionary factor here in New Mexico is the idea that you need to show up with the proper identification. And in some cases, it's not just the fact that people don't want to show up with the identification. It's that they have this libertarian vein within them that says that identifying yourself, people should be able to take their word on identification. You know, do you feel that there's an adequate protection against fraud? I mean, people just walking up to the polls and saying, my name is, and you got to believe me.
Right. Well, actually, I think that a signature requirement is a good thing. Certainly, it's much more difficult to forge a signature on the spot than to forge an ID. You remember a couple of years ago, one of the Bush daughters was stopped for trying to drink with a fraudulent identification. The problem with the photo ID requirement is that particular Americans are excluded. If you were to look at Wisconsin, for example, 23% of senior citizens in Wisconsin don't have an ID, and 78% of young black males ages 18 to 24 don't have a driver's license. And the numbers really do add up. There are 20 million Americans who are voting age who don't have an ID. That's more people than in Delaware, New Mexico, and 14 other states combined. We're already in the bottom 19% of all the democracies in the world in terms of voter turnout here in the United States. Now, that's on one side of the equation. Chris, on the other side, fraud is fairly rare. Studies have shown in Ohio, for example, a study of all the counties there showed only 4 fraudulent ballots cast out of 9 million total. And so, Chris, you know, it sounds reasonable to have a photo ID. People say, well, you know, you need an ID when you go to the airport. But the ID at the airport, it makes much more sense. So, for example, I think it makes sense to exclude 1,000 legitimate flyers who don't have a photo ID if we can stop one terrorist who's going to blow up the plane. But with voting, it doesn't make sense to exclude 1,000 legitimate voters in the off chance that we'll stop one fraudulent voter. Why? Because the objective of democracy is to ascertain the will of all citizens. We want government of, by, and for the people, and it's actually anti-democratic to exclude 1,000 legitimate voters to stop just one fraudulent voter. That is going to result in more erroneous election outcomes rather than fewer. And right now, only 3 states, Georgia, Indiana, and Missouri, have a photo ID requirement. The one in Georgia has actually been blocked by a court as unconstitutional. So I do think that even though a photo ID seems reasonable to most of us, the fact that there are 20 million people who don't have ID, I think we really need to look at the data. Chris, if you tell me that there are many more fraudulent voters than legitimate voters who will be excluded by a photo ID, I'd say, hey, we need a photo ID. That's absolutely right. But we need to look at the numbers. We don't want to end up doing much more harm, essentially, throwing the baby out because the baby has a drop of bathwater on the baby's arm.
Spencer, I'm struck still the fact that in the year 2006 we have reports, you used 1,000 voters getting thrown out there as a hypothetical, but we have numbers in the tens of thousands of voters who were ad hoc excluded from voting, who in many cases went to the polls, actually cast their vote, went through all of the hoops that we put in front of voters, jumped through them all, cast their vote, and then have their vote thrown away. And when we're talking about this new politics of voter suppression, and we've got an America that is locked into a two-party battle that's 50-50, 49-49 all the time. I mean, how much is a little suppression going a long way to win things like these big presidential elections?
Right. I think the stakes are certainly high, and politicians realize they don't have to exclude everyone. I mean, as you suggest, if they can just shave off 2 or 3 percentage points from one particular population, that can, you know, they can win an election and control things. And so they know the stakes are high. And in the old days, you know, in the South, they used literacy tests, poll taxes, and violence to exclude all African Americans pretty much from the polls. Politicians realize they don't have to do that now. They only need to shave off the right 2 or 3% of the electorate, and that can ensure that they win an election and maintain power.
Spencer, thank you so much for joining us here today. The book is Stealing Democracy, The New Politics of Voter Suppression. More information about it, and you can purchase it through the website www.stealingdemocracy.com. Spencer, thanks again for joining us today.
Chris, thank you so much.